Welcome to MP Access, the official podcast of the Five Star Institute and Mortgage Point Magazine. Today I'm here with Bill Bimel of First Lien Capital. Bill, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh my gosh, don't give me such an open-ended question.
I said a little.
You did say a little bit. I'll go on for hours. We'll only get through one question. I have been in real estate about 24 years. Originally from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, raised kids in Jupiter, and around 2008, I fell into buying mortgages, met a gentleman that was buying defaulted loans on the secondary mortgage market, and that was my light bulb moment. I became an advisor, an asset manager for a New York private equity manager for about 10 years. We've probably placed between the various investment partners somewhere around $1.3 billion of money into buying mortgages, mostly non-performing. And then we developed a whole new paradigm around how to handle it and how to make money off of it while still treating people with dignity and making a positive impact on society, I'd like to think.
Love that. That was a little, you did good, because I've heard your full story, and it's a great one. So when you founded First Lien Capital, what was the vision behind it? You've already said a little bit about treating people with dignity and, you know, caring for those assets.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because being a founder, you've realized that maybe your initial vision isn't what you end up having your mission be and your vision. And so it takes some flexibility along the way. My initial vision in creating First Lien Capital was bringing this same investment opportunity to friends and family, to smaller investors. And that is a whole nother job in and of itself.
Yes.
So I've learned a lot along the way. Now that vision has really shifted to having four or five core institutional family office, private individual, high net worth partners that understand what we're up to and in going out and executing our mandate to go out and kind of fix a lot of these troubled real estate and mortgage assets all around the country and then make money doing so. And then the third aspect of that vision is bringing our knowledge to the next generation of investor and manager, because we have now been through almost 18 year uphill valuation, winds at our back. There's almost like a loss of memory. There are people that have left the industry. We're kind of a rare breed to have stuck it out through all of these years. And so we're bringing that knowledge to other, we're helping our partners, we're helping private lenders, banks are coming to us, and then we're teaching the next generation, or creating tools for the next generation to manage what we see as a rising distress level now.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think across the board, we're seeing that. Okay, so I'm so glad you gave me a perfect segue. You talked about educating. For those who are listening and kind of new to this, what does that look like in terms of how do you take a distressed asset and turn it into an upside?
Sure. So we buy a non-performing loan at a discount to the total debt most often. Almost 99% of the time you're buying it at a discount to total debt and at a safe underlying loan to value to the real estate that it encumbers. And it's kind of like the same concept as a fix and flip investor would take, where you know the value of the real estate once it's fixed up, and you know that it's going to take you X amount of time to get there. So it's a discount modeling, where you're subtracting the time, the costs, and your return from where you think this asset will eventually sell a year, 6 months, 2 years down the road. And then getting good at modeling that and executing on that in such a way that you can, you know, increase your returns and give yourself as the investor optionality. Optionality to reperform the borrower, optionality to take a short sale, optionality to put a receiver in place and keep the debtor in possession of the property. You know, buying these things and being a liquidity provider to other lenders. Because most people, banks, mortgage lenders, investors in the mortgage space, they just want the cash flow. They're looking for a yield and a payoff somewhere down the road.
Right.
And when that loan stops performing, whether you're a bank or a private equity manager, the value of it decreases tremendously. And they're just not equipped to handle it. And most originators and lenders will lose significant money on loans that go non-performing. We have a different angle because we're coming in and buying the loans at a discount. So we're starting, you know, from a better position. But now what we're starting to see is we can take these same talents and help other lenders, competitors in the business to limit their losses, mm-hmm. loss mitigation, so to speak.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, I have so many follow-up questions.
Great.
One, what are you seeing in terms of the pattern in hold time? What's changing right now in terms of your length of, you know, holding on to that asset?
That is a good question. Well, it depends. The real estate is very local in nature. So is the mortgage business. Mm-hmm. So from state to state, you model for different timelines.
Correct.
New York State is historically the worst state in the country to try to foreclose in.
Basically eternity.
Yes, exactly. And I actually have seen situations still. There are still situations out there. I had some in my book up until last year where people have been living in houses in New York since 2007 and haven't paid their mortgage and still haven't been foreclosed.
Yep.
So the reverse of that is a lot of the country is it's a pretty short timeline, and so if you're in a state like Texas, you don't have a lot of time to figure stuff out, and so my I don't think that the industry has moved tremendously in terms of non-performing hold times, but I do think that. We're seeing some states are going in the right direction and others are going in the wrong direction. And whereas we used to buy New York and take that on, I won't do it for owner-occupied anymore. We'll do it with commercial loans. But the unfortunate fact is that there's over the last, especially the last 6 years, COVID and beyond, there's been so much government intervention, and for a good reason. You know, we didn't know what was going on in 2020. So the government turned off foreclosures. They turned off evictions. They brought the entire industry to a halt. They changed the rules of GSE servicing, allowing people to basically modify every time they got a cold.
Right.
You know, and that has come to an end. So that's what that's going to do, and it's already happening, is it's increasing the number of defaults. It's increasing the flow of default into the process of foreclosure and mitigation, and it's going to slow the process down industry-wide, but that's okay.
I think when it comes to, as the market shifts, what's prudent is different.
Right.
Right? And that is true for your investing,
mm-hmm.
and that's true for the regulation.
That's right.
Okay, next follow-up question. What kind of relationships do you have to build in your role with those folks that you're buying loans from? Where do you go meet those people, or how do you bid on it, or what's that look like?
It's a great question. It's such an opaque industry. You know, they talk about the secondary mortgage market as if you could go to the local store and buy a mortgage. It just doesn't exist, you know. I used to refer to it as the good old boys network because it really was a bunch of Wall Street guys mm-hmm. that just were on speed dial with each other. And those guys still exist. I actually just flew from New York's MBA secondary conference.
Right.
And it was like the typical old boys network there, where people that manage these pools of mortgages, asset managers, bankers, servicers, are, you know, they choose to, they put together pools, they realize that they've got to raise liquidity, and so it's a lot of personal relationships. Mm-hmm. When I first started First Lien about 5 years ago, all of my early purchases were other funds that were winding out of the business. Big names that had been in it for 10 years or 8 years who just were going into private lending and getting out of the NPL business. So a lot of personal relationships. There is some public ways to get into this market. There are companies like DebtX, Mission Capital, Garnet Capital, that are these large loan sellers, First Financial Network. And you can, if you have a certain qualification, you have a little bit of money, you know, you're a U.S. citizen, you're not a member of the government, you can bid on government mortgages, things like that. But you can go out and find ways to bid on these. Those public auctions, especially in recent years, have not been an area that I could play in, other than one little HUD arena. And that's because a lot of dumb money came into the market and
uneducated money.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Listen, they had their own agenda. I'm not going to name names, but you know, a lot of these groups also own the servicing companies.
Yes.
So they were making more money, and they are to this day still making more money servicing the books than they use leverage and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And then nowadays I use my boots on the ground. So, a lot of my relationships, a lot of how I execute the workouts is through my lawyers and my real estate brokers who are on the ground in various states.
Ah.
And so those same people know what I do. And if they happen to know a local banker that is looking to sell a loan, or that they can start up a conversation because mm-hmm. So I'm getting a lot of stuff that way too. And you just build a reputation as someone that keeps your word, is communicative, is respectful, you know, eventually everyone's calling you all the time. And then they get more choices. So.
So time, good relationship skills, and also, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Just solid industry know-how.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Knowing how to operate within the realms. Mm-hmm. Of,
here we go. Other than New York, what makes a distressed loan something that's resolvable versus problematic?
Everything is resolvable. Mm-hmm. Although... I guess the biggest problems come from a lack of good paperwork. There are lenders
Oh my gosh, yeah. With the transfers?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And that was a problem back in the GFC. It's still a problem today. These insurance companies or these large aggregators of loans that are creating securitizations, they have processes they go through, but they're not really perfect, you know, and they're wrangling a lot of cats. And I think that pricing obviously plays a role in, you know, the optionality that you have when you buy these. I think that there's a right resolution to everything. And one man's problem is another man's opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the stuff we will buy is the hairier stuff because we get bigger discounts and we have the experience and the creativity, and we've seen this enough to know this is the worst that could happen. Mm-hmm. You know, today I think we're going to start to see a large rise in bankruptcies. I think the problem with buying non-performing loans prior to last year that were government loans was you were really hamstrung in your ability to, you lost your optionality.
Right.
And even now. But I don't know if that answered that question.
It did. Well, kind of. You said everything's resolvable. I would think everything is resolvable, but sometimes not with the best ROI.
Correct. Correct. Where you get into issues is really the valuation of the property. And that can be really, you're really seeing a lot of lenders that mm-hmm. just don't know what the real estate's worth. And especially, it amazes me, we were just talking about this last night, that that banks, or not maybe not so much banks, they'll require official appraisals, but a lot of the private lenders out there will, and then a lot of the secondary market buyers out there will make huge $100,000 loans, multi-million dollar decisions off of a $50 BPO, you know, and who's, you know, we know, you and I know the BPO industry. That's, you know, kind of like, you just don't know.
There's good and there's bad.
Exactly. So how do you know you're getting the one from the good, right?
Mm-hmm.
So valuation is key. When we're doing a lot of buying of loans off of a exterior, you know, having people have lived in these properties, so you don't necessarily
know what's inside.
Yeah, and especially we've been buying a lot of HUD HECM loans. These are vacant, dead borrowers. Whenever we can get into the home, it's great, but sometimes they're occupied or you just can't get in. And construction costs are increasing. There's so many hidden. When a home sits vacant for a while, it just builds up deterioration.
Yeah.
And that's probably the biggest risk in what we're doing, is the unknown things inside the property and what it's going to cost to get there. And then, yeah, I mean, I do not make money on every deal that I buy. But Hall of Famers bat 300 in baseball. We do better than 300, obviously. But we're in the Hall of Fame in terms of NPL resolution, but we do not. I actually had a mentor in this business that said, Bill, if you don't lose money on a deal every once in a while, you're not taking enough risk. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. Okay.
It didn't feel good to have. He only said that to me after I had to call him and tell him we lost $40,000 on a property. It was great, though. I mean, I was nervous, and then it was actually a really teaching moment, and I don't feel bad about it now.
It takes a little bit of practice in that thick skin.
Yes.
You know, and remembering the wins.
Yes.
You can't forget the wins inside of the losses.
For sure.
Yeah. Okay, so when you purchase loans, are you looking at them? Two questions. Are you buying them in bulk?
Yes.
But also one-offs?
Yeah.
Okay. And then when you're buying them in bulk, are you looking at them individually as you buy them in bulk and kind of doing the pro forma on those?
Yes. Yeah, we do. We model every single loan, okay. Even if it's a 1,000 loan pool.
Right.
Everything is modeled individually. There are different times at which you're doing bulk, and so there are machinations of that where you might not do a loan level bid, or you might do loan level analysis, and then if the opportunity is availed to do I'll bid X for the whole pool, and I might pay a little bit more than if you're going to cherry pick me back.
Right.
So that does happen, but everything's loan level, so there are so many data points and so many particulars and characteristics mm-hmm. to each individual loan,
right.
Each individual piece of real estate, each borrower's scenario. Sometimes you can see the scenario in the data.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can read about it in the servicing notes. And so you really do have to go loan level and you still don't get it right all the time, of course.
Of course. But writer as
yes.
you go?
We've gotten really good at learning from our mistakes mm-hmm. and correcting for them the next time
mm-hmm.
around,
yeah.
Making adjustments in states. You know, I'll give you an example. I did not know that the District of Columbia in Washington has started this new blight program, where if you have a vacant property in D.C., they will increase your property tax bill by like 10x. Until you've secured the property and renovated it and things like that.
Oh,
this
is,
yeah,
that's
I don't
highly
know.
Punitive.
Yes, it's crazy. Well, obviously we're not, you know, we may lose money on a few of those deals if they take long, because
right.
I've got a property that we thought was a $5,000-$6,000 a year tax load, and it's 50 or 60.
While you're doing that loan level analysis, I'm guessing AI has become an important contributor to your process. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we are. I mean, I am fully on the AI bandwagon, especially since the beginning of this year. Anyone who's tried Claude or ChatGPT last year or the year before and hasn't been on the new models that came out just in the last 90 days, you got to go back and test it out again. I have, first of all, on the reporting side, it's just phenomenal what AI is doing. Really getting a better analysis and picture on my existing portfolio and then presenting that to my investment partners in minutes as opposed to what took, you know, days or weeks. On the modeling side, the same is true. But I don't see AI replacing any of my people. If anything, and I don't look to have AI become a software as a service for, that I'm going to give out. But AI is revolutionary in its ability to manage workflows. You know, I feel like the last post-GFC, the world of Equator and ResNet, that was kind of the first step iteration into the workflow and asset management process, but it's clunky. The cohorts, it worked for the people that were at the top, that were the banks managing tens of thousands of defaults and short sales and stuff. But ask an agent or a lawyer if they like using Equator. I mean, you know, not to badmouth the product. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like
it's designed for a particular user.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I see that I see an opportunity to upend all that, and I'm doing that within my own system. So I've already had my own version of that I had built on kind of the same platforms a few years ago. Now I'm redoing everything again. And I think this year is really a pivot point where smaller operators, when I consider myself a smaller operator, I only have a couple hundred loans that I own right now. And, you know, if you're under $1 billion of managed assets, you're kind of a small guy in the mortgage field. It's just a very cash-intensive business. But guys like myself, I think, have the advantage now. Because the larger institutions, while they're trying AI, it's harder for them to implement it on a nation on a basis. You've got entire teams of IT people. Even my IT people will not go away, by the way, because I have a small enough crew that I still need them to actually implement the AI.
Right.
But what's different about it is it's the first time in my career where myself as the operator is in control of everything. I don't have to play a game of telephone with my IT team. Oh, I want this. Oh, I want that. My IT team is brilliant. They don't know the mortgage industry.
Right.
I can now talk to Claude, and in 10 minutes, I have a new dashboard in my system that I can track a certain thing I want to track. So that's exciting. But I don't think it's going to change... It's not going to change the way. I mean, I'm going to be hiring more people, if anything, because right. I'll be able to take on more.
And you'll be able to do more,
yeah,
not less. Yeah, agreed. So, for those folks who are kind of just getting into this niche in the industry, when you are talking about using AI, in my mind, I'm hearing I get to load all of my 20 plus years of experience into this supercomputer, and it gets to do what I'm looking for it to do.
That's right? Correct.
And so it works really well for you because you have the expertise.
Right.
But for someone who's newer to this, would you recommend that they use AI differently?
That's a great
question.
Because
they don't have that expertise, and then they're going to trust something that maybe doesn't have that expertise either, because I'm assuming your information is siloed, right?
It is siloed, but I'm surprised that, I mean, you have to ask the right questions.
Absolutely. And you have to know what kind of question to ask.
Exactly. And that's probably the biggest, you know, the biggest issue that folks will face coming into this industry is what's the right question.
Right.
Not knowing what you don't know.
Yes.
I mean, listen, I've been in the business now buying loans since 2008. 18 years, that is? Is that what that is? I don't know. My addition's bad.
That is 18. You did good.
And I learn something new every week, every month. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe not every. It used to be every week. Now it's like every month. I just see new things. You know, and even my years of experience. So that is a great question. I would say that you can. There's a lot of good information on the internet, if as long as you're pointing AI at the right context, right? So you're right. I have my own proprietary ways of doing things that is siloed in my rags, and that my agent, my AI agents or whatnot are utilizing, and then combining with publicly available data to create our decision trees and our processes. But I think it's just such a great tool for AI for research that I think it's a great way to educate yourself about the business. Mm-hmm. If you have that, you can just constantly be asking questions. People that are new to this business, if you're in the inquiry and you're willing to be a student of the business, you can gain ahead. You can gain and you can get ahead, and you can learn this business pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. I would assume also you'd highly recommend a mentor alongside AI.
Of course. Maybe I should make him an AI mentor, Dr. Bill.
You should!
Actually, so that it's actually not far from something I'm working on.
Of course.
An AI agent, which I call Dr. Spock. It's meant to be...
Because it has no emotion?
There is also another doctor. So there's a Dr. Spock and a Mr. Spock. And Spock, S-P-O-C, is an industry term that most people have forgotten existed, called single point of contact.
Ah.
And it's the theory that, and by the way, the most frustrations, the most complaints that borrowers have is with their loan servicer, mm-hmm. and having to tell the same story 10
yep.
times.
Yep.
So if I can develop an AI agent... that can act as a mentor to any member of my staff or servicing team, because that's the all-knowing thing, that within a matter of seconds when the borrower calls, the entire history is back mm-hmm. in front of mm-hmm. that person. So, yes, mentorship is key in life and in business. I think that not to be confused with $10,000 rah-rah weekends. You know, like guys that sell themselves as mentors.
Okay, I was like, where are we going with this rah-rah? Where are these weekends? I see, like, Cabos in my mind.
Oh, I would like Davos. That would be real. That's more like $100,000 weekend. Are you kidding? I mean, like, you know, mentorship in the sense of, like, find real people that are doing it and that aren't just out there selling themselves as teachers. And some... people that are selling themselves are teachers, are legitimate teachers.
Right.
But, you know, like any industry, there are those in the know and those that are just out trying to sell a product, you know.
Right. Absolutely. And you are part of a mastermind of investors, right? How did
yes.
you find that group? How did you guys find each other?
It's over the years. I've kissed a few frogs in my career. And then along the way, I've met some really great people. And, like Rob Heith is a perfect example. He's the fixed notes guy. And his whole mission is, like, he starts every meeting with a actual mission statement. And, and it's beyond just how do we make money. It's way beyond that. It's like, it's the last thing is how do we make money. It's how do we effectuate the world in a better place? How do we be good leaders, good husbands, good parents?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we bring curiosity and intellectual thought to our business and pay that forward? So, you know, I've been lucky to find some people like that and I keep them around. I collect good people like you, Gina.
Aw, thank you. I was hoping to be part of the collection, let's be honest. Okay, so were there any questions on here that you were like, ooh, that's a good one, and we haven't covered it?
Oh, there. Well, I think that we can talk. I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, what my new mission today. I think there's a lot of unspoken dislocation coming in real estate and financial markets.
Okay.
And it really comes to do, you know, the affordability thing is an obvious problem.
Yes.
But it's not just, there are so many factors that are causing affordability to be a problem. It's not just inflation. It's the convergence of multiple things that are happening in our society right now. One of them being, you know, the rise of interest rates.
Yes.
The second one being unprecedented debt levels. So now you've got unprecedented leverage and a rise in the cost of that debt. And the other thing that I was really, my eyes were open to a few years ago was the reality of what's happened with our climate on this earth. While the rest of us were worried about 2020 being the COVID year, there was a statistical factual change in the amount of weather-related disaster events. there is last year alone, and so this is not a political conversation. I don't try to get people to recycle more or anything like that, because we are the only country on the planet that still treats climate instability, climate volatility, climate change like it's a political conversation. The reality is what it is. Insurance companies are seeing it. It's mm-hmm. the reason they're pulling out of markets. State Farm pulled, they pulled like 25,000 policies they did not renew in California in 24. And 3 months after that, the Palisades fire happened in 2000. Of those policies were those policies in the Palisades. You're seeing flooding all over the country, all over the world, ice storms in the north, hurricanes in the Carolinas. Tornado Alley is now a tornado highway. And this is just a factual thing that has happened. The earth has become unstable in the last 6 years. And it's going to have a major impact. And what's also interesting for those that, you know, think that I'm like, oh, you know, it's big hype, is that, listen, the earth has been through this before. There's a case to be made for the fall of the Greek Empire, the Athenian Empire. A lot of that, there was a lot of weather instability during the time, famines and droughts and floods and things. Mm-hmm. And for less sophisticated, less technologically advanced right. societies, they just got wiped out. And to think that we have more power than Mother Nature is a fool's errand. So we
hubris.
Yeah, exactly. And other countries all around the world have been planning this for years. Japan, since 1923, has literally had it in their national makeup, disaster recovery.
Right.
You know, they built tunnels to underground below Tokyo to prevent storm waters from flooding the streets, and just the amazing things that Amsterdam has, you know, the Netherlands have done to prevent their stuff. We are sitting right now in New Orleans, and unfortunately, the predictions are that New Orleans will be the first major city in the U.S. that won't be here in 30 years. Jerome Powell said in front of Congress, in front of the Senate Banking Commission last year, that there in 10 to 15 years there will be portions of this country you cannot get a mortgage because you can't even get insurance.
Right.
And so these are just like, these are facts. This is not, I'm not like on a mission to get, like I said, I'm not on a mission to recycle more because I'm just as guilty as the rest of polluting. But, you know, we have to, it's more about like awareness
and
then how do we prepare,
yeah.
you know, and that's what my new book is about.
I was just going to say, so I saw your book, mm-hmm. and I'm curious. I assume that in your book, knowing you, you've got some, like, what do we do next?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, it's a, it's called The Storm, Markets Meets Mother Nature, and it's a kind of a risk management business, and sets the precedent for, let's look at things a little differently here. Mm-hmm. Let's get politics out of the conversation. Let's look at the facts. And then how do we prepare ourselves? So, you know, the three cohorts being the sponsors and borrowers, you know, people that own real estate, lenders and servicers, the people that service real estate and lend against it, and then everyday people. And so I do map out ways that we as a society can have conversations both on a group level. How can we come together to fix the issue? But how can you build personal resilience? I mean, resilience is the one thing that I think I'm most proud of with myself and my family and everything that, you know, I think that that's really measured. Like, the more you, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Mm-hmm. And so we as a society need to do the same thing and build resilience in our infrastructures and rebuild our infrastructure. By the way, this is all going to create new jobs. I mean, when you look at the way what Japan has done they spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and it creates new jobs, it creates new construction to, you know, so there's a lot of, and even private equity is starting to see that now, that there's a real, you get the rise of places like Nuveen that are, you know, seeing the value in investing in our society long term.
Mm-hmm. How do you take these weather-related truths and inject them into your projections?
That's the big question, right? That's a good question. I have for instance, right now, I am, as someone who's lived 38 of my 50 years on this planet in the state of Florida, I've been through a couple storms. I've seen it. I'm really cautious about investing in Florida right now. I have friends of mine who sold most of their commercial real estate portfolio to relocate that money into better territories. We all love Florida, but there's a real problem there with insurance costs and everything and the price of things right now. Yeah. So we are making those adjustments. We are constantly studying the data. We are we are buying our own types of insurance outside of what the servicers or others are doing. And we are showing up at think tanks and saying, you know, we got to bring the industry together. And it was that the think tank in D.C. 3 years ago that my eyes were opened. Here was a room full of private equity, bankers. You know, these are conservative guys.
Yep.
In the same room with climatologists and government workers. And the rule was, leave your politics at the door. Let's have a serious conversation. And when the serious conversation started, it became apparent that this is an us problem. We're only going to fix this together.
Right. So we have talked about relationships in terms of mentoring, in terms of the market and working with people. Mm-hmm. You also spoke in the beginning about how First Lien is focused on being human while caring for these distress loans.
Correct.
Where does the human element matter most? Mm-hmm. And how do you, what have you learned over the years in terms of how to kind of employ that?
Yeah, I mean, this business of managing non-performing, sub-performing is not for the faint of heart. And cannot be written into a manual. You cannot place every borrower into a system or a bureaucracy. This is the great problem of loan servicing. You know, the loan servicers are forced to manage thousands, if not tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of loans. And you can't apply the same standard to every situation. And really, that's something we recognized early on, back in 2008. Everyone was underwater, but not everyone's story was the same. There were people that generally wanted to keep these homes, and they just, you know, their mortgage was all of a sudden twice the value of the home.
Right.
You know, so how can we go in there? And so my first book was actually, that I published in 2017, was exactly about this thing. It's called Win-Win Revolution. And I didn't want to be a debt collector. I wanted to be a real estate guy. And the last thing I ever wanted to do was be in the debt collection business.
Yeah.
And so we set out to create a paradigm about how do we do this with where we treat people like humans and that we treat them with dignity. Just because someone's failing on their mortgage doesn't make them a bad person. They got into a situation, you know, we've all gotten into that situation where, maybe they're hiding, maybe they're communicating. It's really about listening to the borrower. And that's the key component to this whole thing that we do that no one else does. I mean, you know, a servicer will ask a question, but then they'll go back to, well, here's the list of things I can do for you. And being able to be flexible and borrower first. So the first thing is, we know they're behind on their mortgage. They know they're going to lose the home if they don't talk to you or don't pay. So we have a lot of leverage walking into the conversation. We don't need to rub it in their face. You know, we don't need to have the Miranda call and the, you owe us $40,000 in past due when you're sending a check. Obviously, they would not be calling for that, you know, I mean, most of the time, unless they hit the lotto. So it's really about, like, the first thing we always do is ask, how do you see this playing out? What are your intentions? And get a real read on who the person is. Mm-hmm. And when we were buying mortgages post-GFC, the first 35, 40% of every pool, we would get people reperforming. We had one of the highest reperformance rates in the industry. We set a standard where we would also do modifications correctly. A lot of banks would take the past due, like if people were underwater, they'd create two notes or a second, first and second. So, you know, you would be paying on a first at today's property value back in 2010, and then there'd be this phantom second hanging out there, which that's a whole nother story. And that's, you know, and it really, you know, so you had a higher default rate. There was less equity back for the borrowers. We were forgiving debt. We never did that kind of thing. So we forgave a lot of debt. We put people in equity positions for people that realized that they couldn't stay, or that we realized they just can't afford this house or this property. Allow them to exit with dignity. Give them the option of avoiding foreclosure by taking a deed in lieu. Give them a cash for keys if they're an owner-occupied house. We even set them up in a rental. Whatever we can do to help the situation. And then there's some portion that you just have to foreclose. Sometimes you have title issues. A lot of what we're buying with the Heckams, the borrower has passed away, the heirs are nowhere to be found, and you have to take it through a foreclosure process to clear title.
Right.
But that is I think we've developed a really unique model because we've never had a CFPB complaint. We're very hands-on as an investor. We've never had problems with any kind of... I have borrowers that are like literally sending me Christmas cards still every year, that, you know, that for 15 years later, because I helped them save their home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like their own little personal bailout. So that feels good.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. I got to be on your podcast once.
That's right.
I'm glad that you get to be on ours.
It's about time.
A pleasure. Yes, it is. So glad you're here. Glad you're at Velocity and in New Orleans.
Hopefully enjoy it. Oh my gosh, New Orleans is amazing. I'm going to have some beignets this afternoon.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
I love that plan. A little afternoon pick-me-up.
That's right. That's right.
Great. And thank you for joining us. We hope you learned a lot about non-performing loans with humanity. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to MP Access. Stay up to date with daily mortgage news, featured stories, and our latest episodes of the podcast at themortgagepoint.com. Don't miss out, and we'll see you next week.